At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. Whether your pursuit involves a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree, GCU's learning environments are designed for supportive networking and collaboration. With over 330 academic programs, GCU provides a path to help you fulfill your dreams. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Hi, this is For the Girls Podcast. I am Nick Westray.
I'm Jason Black.
This is a podcast about queer people and their obsession with female performers, also known as divas.
Yes, this is. Sometimes we cover a full career of one diva, or sometimes we just cover the works of some divas. Sometimes it's multiple divas. It's all kinds of things. Sometimes we just go to Cabot Cove and hang out there for a while. We do all kinds of things.
We do album reviews. We watch television shows that you don't watch. We also watch really old movies. Jason, who's this a podcast for?
This is a podcast for the Ten Commandments of Divadom.
Oh, this is a podcast for ex-vaudevillian female companions.
This podcast is for girls as pure as New York snow.
This is a podcast for understudies.
This is a podcast for my bumpy ride or die bitches.
Yes, that's a good one. I'm ending there.
Who do we have?
What
do
we have? I'm so excited about this. We've been wanting him on since we started this podcast. This week we have on journalist Mark Harris, friend of the podcast, amazing writer, film knowledge supreme master. Hi, Mark.
Hi, not guys. Intimidating at all. And Mark and I share the exact same opinions, so I'm just going to agree. I'm that smart. I can just agree with everything you say.
This will be very fast.
It'll be really easy. And I'm going to shamelessly plug, Mark has a book coming out in February that I've been waiting for ever since I heard he was writing it. It's called Mike Nichols, A Life. And everyone should pre-order it for everyone they know for Christmas, and then just write them a little note, tell them they're going to get it on February 2nd.
That's right. It's the perfect gift for someone you're feeling kind of passive-aggressive about, and you want to say, like, I got you a present, but you're not getting it for 6 weeks.
Exactly. It's perfect timing.
Yeah, send it to them on Valentine's Day.
That's really good. Yes.
Yes. How are you, Mark? Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm doing well.
Good.
This is our Thanksgiving episode, right? This is the Thanksgiving week.
This is Thanksgiving week. And what are we talking about, Mark? Who are your divas this week?
Well, we're talking all about Eve, right?
Mm-hmm. All about this podcast.
Which I think Nick, you pointed out that there's like, you know, an array of women you can choose from just in this movie. I mean, we have Bette Davis, we have Anne Baxter, we have Celeste Holm, we have Thelma Ritter, who I would certainly qualify as a diva, and Marilyn Monroe.
It's too.
And George Sanders, who is like almost a woman.
He's playing a diva.
In this movie, yes. He is a diva.
He's
so many controversial takes on Addison. Oh, my God.
Oh, Addison DeWitt. I mean, I was obsessed with all of these divas except for Anne Baxter, really, as a kid. But kind of obsessed with Anne Baxter because of the Ten Commandments. But I was obsessed with Thelma Ritter since How the West Was Won, which I don't know why my dad made me watch a lot when I was a kid. And I was like, this lady is for me.
That really falls under, like, they should have known. Like, you watched How the West Was Won, and your takeaway was Thelma Ritter.
More exactly. Thelma Ritter movies, please.
Six-time Academy Award nominee Thelma Ritter, and this was her first nomination.
Right. And I think maybe her greatest, you know, the greatest of all Thelma Ritter moments are for me in this movie, although she's really wonderful in other ones, too.
When was the first time you saw this movie? Can you remember?
Oh, gosh. I think it was in a movie theater. like a revival theater when those existed. I want to say downtown, and I feel like it was in the presence of like older, gay men. Like I was pretty young, and there were definitely people in the audience, I think, who knew every reference and were laughing like in advance of things, and you could feel like some scenes begin and there'd be this collective intake of air because they knew what was coming and I didn't. So it was a little like watching it through this filter of old gay knowledge, which probably meant that I actually didn't see the movie that clearly the first time that I was watching it through this kind of like very high level gay static.
Well, it was kind of like, because they were treating it as camp, right? Like as.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it was, I don't know if they were treating it with camp, because I think what was really being expressed was sort of pure love at the screen. I mean, it wasn't, you know, the great thing is there's nothing about, I don't think there's anything about the movie that is unintentionally funny. Like it knows where its laughs are. It knows where its wit is. And, you know, there are certain things, there are certain moments when like a couple of actors don't seem entirely in on the joke. But mostly everybody's on the same page and like they know exactly what they're doing. And that's one of the things I think that's really exciting about it.
Well, do you think there's a campy lens to it? Cause I feel like the wit is more sardonic, and
it depends on how you define campiness. Like it's, you know, it definitely takes place in this oversized world of the theater. And also like, interestingly, in this oversized world of women, where although the playwright is a man and the director is a man and the critic is a man, this is a story that's really run by the women in it. You know, so it's kind of a world that they own. So it doesn't feel like camp to me, but it does feel like almost the imagining of an alternate universe in 1950, in which, you know, like, because notoriously in All About Eve, the two unambiguously straight men, Bill, the director, and Lloyd, the playwright, are both kind of lumps, you know? They're not really interesting as people, and when they each have like a couple of witty things to say, but mainly they're not as good at doing that as the women are, you know.
Yeah, like, I was so bored with Lloyd at the beginning of the movie and his whole treatise on the theater to Eve. I was like, oh gosh, Betty, change that clothes faster, please.
Right, or when Bill, you know, goes into that rant about you and all your barroom Benzedrine, you know, like,
yeah,
when the men go off on people, except of course for Addison,
yes,
it's not that interesting, it's not that great. When the women do, it's always fantastic, and it's often really concise. Like, it's not a really long rant. It's Birdie saying,
when she gets like this, all of a sudden, she's playing Hamlet's mother.
Or, you know, I'm going into the bathroom until you get normal.
That whole first Birdie take.
Bathroom. I mean, Birdie in the bathroom for hours.
I've been thinking about this movie over the past week as like, what are my four favorite moments of these four women in the film? And for me with Birdie, it's the moment where she comes out of that bathroom, she decides she's going to be a part of this and hear what Eve has to say at the top of the movie. And she lances into Eve like that, right after Eve has turned on literally the violins playing under her big sob story of her past. And Birdie comes right at her with,
what a story. Everything but the bloodhound snapping at her rear end.
There are some human experiences, Birdie, that do not take place in a vaudeville house, and that even a fifth-rate vaudevillian should understand and respect.
Right. Like, she's the only character in the movie,
the arguably, teeth, the fangs.
Like, she knows the truth about everyone. Mm-hmm. Like, even Addison, you could say there's probably a part at the beginning of the movie where he's fooled, where he's taken in by Eve. But
right.
But Birdie never is, which leads to like one of the great enduring mysteries of All About Eve, which is what happens to Birdie? Like, where does she go?
Where does she go? I mean, I was thinking that in the scene where Betty Davis is, when Margot is reading the article, Addison's article aloud to Karen, I was like, why isn't Birdie in the scene?
Right.
She still lives in the house. Like, after the party, she's gone, right?
I mean, it's not a short movie. You know, it's over 2 hours. So I can imagine why they didn't want to make it longer, although of course I love every minute of it.
Yeah.
But it you really want Birdie back for one like rounding it all out scene in the last third of the movie. It's always been like a disappointment that we don't get that.
Yeah, or you want her to have been at the Sarah Siddon Society or something.
Right.
You know, like
totally
getting Margot's coat at
in the coat room, I was gonna say. You know, or she should be working the bar. Oh,
man, but well, talk about just stealing a whole movie.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Okay, let me do this. I'm going to out myself. I'm going to come out of the closet to the gay wolves.
Come out.
And be
come
torn
out.
To pieces. This was my first time seeing this movie.
It's never too late.
Thank you. Thank you. At 24. Welcome. At 24. I'm so long in the tooth that now with the mask and they still don't even ask for my ID. I'm like, oh well, there we are. You can't even see my face and you're not gonna card me.
Have it.
The eyes give it away, isn't it, my friend?
So how was your first time?
Well, so here's the thing with Birdie and everything. All About Eve seems like an art, you know, the architecture of women's films and a certain dynamic that seems now tales as old as time for me. And so I was really ready for the full-blown melodrama and catfighting that I think a lot of films have tried to mimic and kind of done so with a lot of lesser success. And so right away watching this, I was like, oh, so Birdie's going to be always the kind of the nag and the truth teller. And I think originally she was maybe written like that. She was originally written to be more outing about Eve, but they wanted Eve. They didn't want that for the audience until kind of the middle of the movie. But I love how every time I kind of thought I knew what I was seeing, it takes a more naturalistic approach to it. It doesn't. Yeah. Does that make sense? So I was really surprised at how actually less campy it was. It was not the thing I thought I was seeing. It was more moving.
I think it is a moving movie. I mean, it's very funny, but it's also emotional. And yeah. I think the reason I hesitated when you said campy before is because it's an incredibly self-aware movie, and the characters are really self-aware. Like, these are people who all, on some level, know that they are performing. I mean, you know, and when they forget it for a second, another character reminds them that they're performing, you know.
You're too short for that gesture. Besides, it went out with Mrs. Fisk.
I mean, like, the real way that Addison destroys Eve at the end is in a way by saying to her, you're not as good an actress as you think you are. Like, you're great on stage, but as a person, you're not quite pulling this off as well as you have to. And, you know, Margot is constantly being reminded by other characters, whether it's Bill or Lloyd or, you know, even Birdie or Addison, that she's being a kind of oversized version of herself to create an effect. You know, they say things like, I've seen you like this before, you know, at the beginning of the party, when Lloyd comes in and ungrammatically, by the way, for a playwright, says,
what has or is about to happen?
which always makes me think, like, you're not that good a writer. I bet.
Well, he also named his plays "Aged in Wood" and "Footsteps on the Ceiling." So
I love right. "Aged in Wood,"
and "Remembrance," which you just know is a really boring one.
See, I don't think all about Eve is campy at all. I don't think Betty Davis's performance to me reads campy at all. But I'm interested in the revival of her after Baby Jane. And right. how really the gays kind of took it and kind of back cataloged her into this camp icon. And that's why I was wondering, when you were watching this and everyone knew all of the lines, almost as if they were viewing it kind of like a Rocky Horror Picture Film. They were anticipating the line and already laughing and celebrating it, you know, kind of reclaiming it and putting it in a certain canon that I don't. And that's, I think that's fine. I think that's beautiful. I think that there's love and adoration towards it, but it's just. And I do think it has to do maybe with the Betty Davis again of it all, in her 60s, in the 60s.
And also, I mean, I think there is this, if you go back into gay history in like the late 50s and 60s and even early 70s, when more people were in the closet and like homosexuality was, at least in places like New York and San Francisco, largely communicated in kind of shared cultural references. Like, you were supposed to have seen certain performances, you were supposed to appreciate certain things, you were supposed to know certain things. And All About Eve was absolutely one of those things that you were supposed to know about. It
a touchstone.
Yeah, absolutely a touchstone. And part of it is because, you know, Addison certainly reads as gay, you know, in his wit and in his acidity, and you know, despite his apparent sexual interest in women, the sort of showdowns between Margot and Addison were like encoded gay bitchery, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's something that like gay men absolutely 50 or 55 years ago would have intuited. And I think that's part of the reason that it got this, to me, slightly undeserved reputation for camp, was the idea that you know, All About Eve was one kind of movie on the surface, but if you really spoke its language, you knew that something else was going on.
I distinctly remember Addison crossing you off my guest list. What are you doing here?
Dear Margot, you were an unforgettable Peter Pan. You must pray it again soon. You remember Miss Caswell, don't you?
I do not. How do you do?
We've never met. Maybe that's why.
Miss Caswell is an actress, a graduate of the Copacabana School of Dramatic Art.
Well, I love when Addison DeWitt defines gay people. I mean, in the celluloid closet, the documentary, they also reference this as a gay history, as Eve being kind of a lesbian icon, possibly.
Totally.
And I just, this, in the end of the movie, during their showdown, when he talks about,
you're an improbable person, Eve, and so am I. We have that in common. Also a contempt for humanity, an inability to love and be loved, insatiable ambition and talent. We deserve each other.
Like, all these cliches that, to me, I was like, oh, this is Addison defining fags to everybody in this moment. And that they were these lost vipers who had to, like, cling on to each other in the darkness. That was so, it's amazing.
Completely, like it's sort of gay people as theater people / vampires. Like, yes. You know, we're not like normal human beings, and we deserve each other and all of that. And yeah, you're totally right about Eve herself, because in the last scene of the movie, which is like, if you want to read Eve as a kind of almost murderous lesbian trope, you know, the when we finally see her kind of alone and unguarded in her apartment or her hotel suite, whatever, after she has won the Sarah Siddons Award, you know, her voice seems to drop an octave into this kind of butch, like, register of like,
who are you?
Miss Harrington.
What are you doing here?
And you kind of get the sense that including in her own narrative, Eve has never seemed particularly interested in men. They're tools to get her what she wants, which is fame and opportunities and great parts. But the scenes in the movie, like, she's interested in Margot. Like,
yeah.
That's her, that's the real dynamic. That's the person she wants to kind of beat, not Addison. So it's made, you could say that she's a kind of encoded lesbian. You could also say that she is, in a way, like a woman's woman, that she's just a woman whose primary interest is other women.
There's also, I also found that speech at the near the end of the party that she gives about applause very queer.
Why, if there's nothing else, there's applause. I've listened backstage to people applaud. It's like waves of love coming over the footlights and wrapping you up. Imagine to know every night that different hundreds of people love you. They smile, their eyes shine, you've pleased them. They want you. You belong. Just that alone is worth anything.
You know, this idea of just knowing that you belong. Like, she does seem like an orphan in search of a home, which, at least for me as a queer person who, like, ended up in the theater, it really was always for me, you know? And that moment I was like, oh, because I had never even thought about her as a queer character or a lesbian character until I was doing research for this episode and found out that that's, like, a big line of thinking around this movie. And then it kind of colored my view of it. And this is my second favorite movie of all time. I've seen it at least 100 times in my life since I was 12. But it really struck me this time when she talked about applause in that scene. And I was like, oh yeah, I like thinking of her as a queer character, like some different in that way.
Well, the interesting thing to me is, like, why is Eve a villain? Why is she?
Is she?
You know, Little Miss Evil or whatever, mm-hmm. Margot calls her.
Evil. Little Miss Evil.
It's like, she is a villain, I think, but it's not because she's ambitious. It's not because she wants things, because, after all, Margot is like, you know, we hear that she sort of stepped out of the chorus line at the, you know, she made her first appearance at the age of 2, and she's been dazzling people ever since. So, like, Margot is obviously incredibly ambitious. Mm-hmm. And the only moment in the movie that Margot has that doesn't ring true, really, is that kind of awful speech that she has to give in the car about, you know, if you don't have a man, you're not a woman, you're just a thing with a suite of French provincial furniture, and, you know.
Right.
Like, I don't really, it's the only thing in the movie I don't really believe, because I don't believe that she believes it. You know, she's never, I think it's self-pity, but and insecurity, but I think, like.
But part of that monologue is so great, though, right? Like, I feel like you could slice that monologue in half. Part of it is a perfect, and then the end is such a, I guess, a contemporary letdown, but.
Right. I think that's true. There's great stuff in it. But like, Eve is terrible because of the way she treats other people. Not yes. because of what she wants.
Right. And the way that she uses is willing to destroy other people in order to get what she wants. Her methods are what are so contemptible, especially around poor Karen Richards, who's just trying to be a wife of the theater.
But see, I think Margot's horrible. I mean, what I love about this is at the beginning, Margot's horrible. She's so unpleasant to the people around. You know, she's been on this pedestal for so long that she's kind of nasty to everyone.
I mean, I think she's delightful, though Margot would hate this podcast with what she says about fans
right.
at the beginning of the movie. She goes off about
autograph fiends. They're not people. Those little beasts that run around in packs like coyotes. They're your fans, your audience. They're nobody's fans. They're juvenile delinquents. They're mental defectives. They're nobody's audience. They never see a play or a movie even. They're never indoors long enough.
It's so good. But she seems, I mean, I love Margot, and I think she seems
Don't get me wrong,
fun.
I think she's delicious, but I also don't think she's an angel. Or kind.
But the thing is, when she's being awful, and I think this is the thing that makes her not awful, she always knows she's being awful. And
she's
direct.
You think it's better to be direct
in your nastiness? There are times in the movie where people say to her various versions of stop being awful, and she kind of... She only fights back when she thinks she has real reason to be awful, but she kind of knows that she's, you know, she knows how she is. She knows how she behaves, and like, she's very smart. She's a really smart character. Nick, what I want to ask you is, how hard do you relate to, as an actor, to the moment in the ladies' room at the Cub Room, where Eve says to Karen,
"I'd do much more for a part that good."
I mean, that's one of my favorite lines, which is Cora's my part. My first play ever was in San Francisco. It was a production of The Merchant of Venice, directed by Daniel Fish, my first professional job. And there was a brilliant actor named Danny Shea, who was in it with me, who's like San Francisco theater royalty. And I was very young, playing Bassanio, the male ingenue role. And every time I would walk into the dressing room, he would grab his powder puff and go, "Cora's my part. No one can play her like I can." And it was amazing every day. So I do identify with it. I would do so much for a part that good. I mean, I had a cry in this movie. I've been kind of angry at the theater since the shutdown, or thinking I hate the theater because I hate Zoom theater so much, and I hate, I don't know, everything that I've been mad at Actors Equity. I've just been mad at the whole thing. Not that it's the theater's fault, but I've been kind of like, I hate the theater. And then I watched this movie, and Bette Davis's line at the Cub Room when she says,
"He does not exaggerate, I was good."
About her performance that night, I lost it. Because those nights are so powerful, that thing of like knowing you're good and knowing your worth in it, when you feel that is so huge. And for everything that Margot is under, all the pressure with Bill and Eve, that's my favorite scene with Margot. I think she's so magnanimous and so beautiful and happy. And I was just so happy for her, and it made me miss doing it. It made me miss the Glasshouse Tavern. It made me miss Joe Allen's. It just made me miss it in a way I haven't let myself, because this whole thing has been so debilitating and awful.
Yeah, it's more than almost any movie of the period, and certainly more than most Hollywood movies about the theater. It really seems to understand theater, and it seems to understand New York at that time. Like, it sort of gets that theater people are amazing creatures, and what it kind of costs you and what it fills you with to put yourself on a stage every night. You know, it's this really kind of, aside from everything else, this physical athletic endeavor that kind of reshapes your days. It reshapes your nights. You live on a different calendar than other people. You live on a different 24-hour clock than other people.
And it reshapes your psyche in a very specific way. And I've known Eve Harringtons, and by that I just mean people who, I mean, and a couple who I went to school with who are very famous now, who when you would see them coming down the hall, you moved out of the way because they were going to do whatever it took to be famous. And I never wanted to fuck with people like that.
Just say their names. Nobody will know. I won't tell.
Just a couple friends. Listen, just a couple friends here. And you know what? I can't even barely have enough ambition to pour water for myself. But I absolutely adore those monsters. And so that's maybe why I have such sympathy for Eve. I really do. I have such sympathy for Eve. Do we really believe... Answer us this. Do we really believe that all of Eve's motivations were for her self-success? Or do we think that she actually really did love Margot and really did worship her? I mean, we know that she was lying about a lot of this, but what do we think?
I don't know, little Gertrude Schlafinski?
To begin with, your name is not Eve Harrington. It's Gertrude Schlafinski.
I mean, the weird... I don't know if you guys have ever seen the movie A Place in the Sun, the George Stevens movie.
Yes, we did for our Elizabeth Taylor episode earlier this year. Yes.
Well, it's a weird comparison to make to All About Eve, I know, but they came out at almost the exact same moment. And like, I feel sympathy for Eve in the same way that I feel sympathy for Montgomery Clift, because both of those movies like articulate so beautifully the pain of wanting something so much and having your nose pressed right up against the glass and knowing that on the other side of it lies this whole world that you want to be a part of and that you absolutely believe you could master if they would just let you in the door. And you know, in A Place in the Sun, of course, it turns someone into literally a murderer. But the Eve that is at the beginning of the movie, who comes in and tells her whole story to Margot and Birdie and Karen and Lloyd and Bill, the whole gang, that turns out to be a lie.
It was just Mom and Dad and me. I was an only child. Used to make believe a lot when I was a kid. Acted out all sorts of things. What they were isn't important. But somehow, acting and make-believe began to fill up my life more and more. It got so I couldn't tell the real from the unreal. Except that the unreal seemed more real to me. I'm talking a lot of gibberish, aren't I?
Not at all.
Farmers were poor in those days. That's what Dad was, a farmer. I had to help out. So I quit school, went to Milwaukee, became a secretary in a brewery. When you're a secretary in a brewery, it's pretty hard to make believe you're anything else. Everything is beer. It wasn't much fun, but it helped at home. And there was a little theater group there, like a drop of rain on the desert. That's where I met Eddie. He was a radio technician. We paid Lillian for 3 performances. That was awful. Then the war came, and we got married. Eddie was in the Air Force. They sent him to the South Pacific. You were with the OWI, weren't you, Mr. Richards? That's what Who's Who says. Well, with Eddie gone, my life went back to beer. Except for a letter a week. 1 week he wrote me he had leave coming up. I'd saved my money and vacation time and went to San Francisco to meet him. But Eddie wasn't there. They forwarded the telegram from Milwaukee, the one that came from Washington, to say that Eddie wasn't coming at all. That Eddie was dead.
Yeah, you can say, like, okay, she's a sociopath from the first, but you also have to remember the backstory to that, which is she has apparently been standing out there every night for weeks,
yeah,
waiting for her moment. And she, on that level, she is sort of a fascinating, formidable, like, I can't fully hate someone who wants something that badly. You know?
And she's obviously talented because, I mean, when she steps in to read with Miss Caswell, she was ready for it. She obviously has the ability, if her star shot up that high that fast.
Right.
Like,
right.
I love that in the movie you never see either of them perform. You see Bette Davis bow and you right. see Eve rehearse a bit, but you never see them act, and it leaves that to the imagination, which I love.
And we're talking about a community that is so small and insular. You know, and good and being kind doesn't get you anywhere. Come on, we know this. Just being right. kind mm-hmm. and genteel doesn't you're not gonna be a leading actress by being like that. You know, she's a nobody. She has to do something, and I applaud that she really, you know. My God, right, this is like a home. I know. Listen to this.
You evil bitch.
I applaud for her Home Alone scheming plan. That really works. It works.
She's really the Macaulay Culkin of 1950.
Absolutely.
And I love this comparison. Thank you. Go with it.
Thank you. I'm just saying it works. I applaud that. I mean, again, we all press our noses against the glass and be like, just on this other side is riches and fame. you know, I'm this close, but I have no idea how to access these people. You should see
the
thing,
Mark, if you only knew the things that we did to get a podcast this massively successful, you'd be shocked.
The bodies in our wake.
I'm sure they're like just out of camera range.
Yes, I guess I am an even apologist, I have to say. I think Karen's the real of it all.
Well,
what?
I tweeted this as a joke, but like there is a read that Karen is the actual villain.
Yes. Thank you.
Because look what she does. She brings the poison person into the community in the first place. She traps Margot in their miserable country house or wherever they live in Connecticut so that she misses that performance.
Mm-hmm.
She drains
the gas tank.
Come on.
Karen is a Karen.
Blue. Oh, this is where it started. This is where it all started. We have uncovered this.
But my favorite moment of the entire film, and there are a couple of these. You brought it up earlier, Mark, about how the film is self-aware, is at the Cub Room when Karen lets out that laugh.
When she gets it for herself.
When Margot says...
I don't want to play Cora.
What?
Now, wait a minute. You're always so touchy about his plays. It isn't the part. It's a great part and a fine play. But not for me anymore. Not for a four-square, upright, downright, forthright married lady.
What's your being married got to do with it?
It means I've finally got a life to live. I don't have to play parts I'm too old for. Just because I've got nothing to do with my nights. Oh, Lloyd, I know you've made plans. I'll make it up to you, believe me. I'll tour a year with this one, anything. Only you do understand, don't you?
What's so funny?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Everything. Everything's so funny.
It's just this dramatic irony that Mankiewicz, it's a Karen is feeling what the audience is feeling, and we're all feeling it together. It's an amazing moment.
But it's also so like, oh my God, I sold my soul for nothing and I didn't have to, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I have to say, as a playwright's wife, the lowest form of celebrity.
Yes, you know, you are the Karen.
I am Karen, yeah.
But
I'm
still,
the Karen in the story.
No, but here's this is why I do feel something, because you still are part of the, you still are very much, not just tangentially a part of this world, you're very in the mix of this world, the writer of it all. But Karen's got nothing. I mean, she's one divorce away from being under Eve. You know, she has no power. So all of the, you know, she has the least agency of this film. And I actually, so as much as I'm like, oh, Karen, you're the nasty one, I also feel like so bad for Karen because she's, you know, she's grandfathered into this place that no one really cares about her opinion.
Don't you just want to go and have lunch?
She has to find power.
Don't you just want to go have lunch with her and Margot at 21, though?
Margot and I were having lunch at 21. Just like girlfriends, with hats on.
Like, I would love to know, when you think, what did they go on to? Like, you know, I assume that Miss Caswell actually did go on to have a very nice career in television. I hope she did, because she's not a bad person. And, you know, Eve clearly goes on to great fame, and Margot clearly stays famous. But what does Karen do? Like...
She wallpapers the house in Connecticut.
That's right. She gets that country house turned up every 5 years. Projects.
Is that marriage really going to last, though?
Yeah, I don't know.
Because I think there's big unanswered things in the movie that are sort of interesting. Hmm. Like, minor stuff, like, do Margot and Bill get married by the end of the movie?
I think so.
And, but also, like, was... Do you think Lloyd was having an affair with Eve?
I don't think he was having an affair. I think the way that Eve breaks down with Addison tells us that. But I think that there's kind of an emotional or like one of those like, you know, showmance crush platonic things happening between the two of them.
Right. Like there's something that was worrisome enough so that Karen arranged that lunch with Addison, that he refers to, and arranged it because she was in search of information, as he tells Eve. So
I had lunch with Karen not 3 hours ago, as always with women who try to find out things she told more than she learned.
But that moment, you're right, that moment between Karen and Lloyd when he says...
That bitter cynicism of yours is something you've acquired since you left Radcliffe.
That cynicism you refer to, I acquired the day I discovered I was different from little boys.
That's a good moment for Karen.
Yeah, but that, I mean, it shows you the rift between them. You know, that she is kind of drifting closer to Margot-ness in a positive way for her, I think.
Right. Which is funny because she starts as this kind of tiger wife in a way, who, like, she's the first person really to yell at Margot when she says, you know,
I find these wisecracks increasingly less funny. Aged in Wood happens to be a fine and distinguished play.
That's my loyal little woman.
Well, the critics thought so. The audiences certainly think so. Packed houses, tickets 4 months in advance. I can't see that Lloyd's plays have hurt you any.
I mean, that I love that because that sort of suggested a lot of after show conversations or after rehearsal conversations when Lloyd went home and like bitched and moaned to Karen about Margot, you know,
totally,
which, you know, happened
that's the whole thing. His whole takedown of actors is just a body and a voice. That whole fight between Margot and Lloyd is like, is something I've felt so many times when they really, I mean, directors feel it too, when they really think that you don't have an independent thought, that you are just my friend Betty Gilpin says that they often think that we're flesh bots, you know, that right. You just wind us up. We're just robots with flesh. And
I don't know what's wrong with that, because I think Eve is a flesh bot and she can access anything if you just program her right. And that's why I love my Evie. It's just a little robot actor.
All playwrights should be dead for 300 years.
That would solve none of their problems, because actresses never die. The stars never die and never change.
You may change this star anytime you want for a new and fresh and exciting one. Fully equipped with fire and music, anytime you want, starting with tonight's performance.
This is for lawyers to talk about. This concerns the run of the play contract that you cannot rewrite or ad lib.
Are you threatening me with legal action, Mr. Fabian?
Are you breaking the contract?
Answer my question.
Who am I to threaten? I'm a dying man.
I don't hear you.
I said I'm a dying man.
Not until the last drugstore has sold its last pill.
I shall never understand the weird process by which a body with a voice suddenly fancies itself as a mind. Just when exactly does an actress decide they're her words she's saying and her thoughts she's expressing?
Usually at the point when she has to rewrite and rethink them to keep the audience from leaving the theater.
It's about time the piano realized it has not written a concerto.
It's pretty great, though, because you do get the sense that everyone in that world, playwrights, actresses, aspiring actresses, they all want respect. They all want to be seen as, you know, intelligent and autonomous. Even like that great passing reference that Birdie makes, you know, to the wardrobe woman when she says,
"May I be so bold as to say something? Have you ever heard of the word union?
Behind in your dues, how much?
I haven't got a union. I'm slave labor.
Well?
But the wardrobe women have got one, and next to a tenor, a wardrobe woman is the touchiest thing in show business.
Oh.
She's got two things to do. Carry clothes and press them wrong. And don't let anybody try to muscle in.
Like, it's all about needing to be appreciated.
Or when Birdie says,
and as for being fifth rate, I closed the first half for 11 years and you know it.
Exactly. Like, this career that isn't even her career anymore really means something to her. And that's why, in so many ways, Bill is the least interesting character in the movie, because he's the only one with no interior. He's just this kind of gorilla. Like, you never really hear that, like, he's worried about his direction or he's concerned about his career. He's just like basic dumb, straight, male, like, forward motion. I can't believe Betty Davis
married
him.
Which I fucking love about this movie is that
Betty Davis married him in real life, everyone. Yes. Yeah, after
the actor.
I read a quote from Celeste Holm that they had a party a couple days in, or right before they started shooting in San Francisco. And she said, Betty saw Gary and Gary saw Betty. And from then on, none of the rest of us even existed.
Betty hated Celeste, I guess. I guess that's the one person she despised.
Yeah, right. Well, there's that great story that, you know, Celeste Holm walked on the set the first day and said good morning to everyone. And Betty Davis said, oh, shit, good manners. and like thereafter, they had nothing to do with each other. Here's like the amazing piece of trivia, if you can call it that, that I've always held on to. I don't know if this is true or not, but like, I'm so in awe of what actors do, stage actors and film actors, because I think those are completely different kinds of pressure. But my God, like, you have to deliver. You always have to deliver in the moment. And I read that Betty Davis did her entire part in All About Eve in 13 days.
Yeah.
Like,
I think that, it might be 16.
But 13, yeah. 16.
Yeah.
But to me, it's like, for this monumental thing that we're still talking about 70 years later, and that seems so incredibly worked through. I mean, you know, in that great scene where before the party starts, she has that huge fight with Bill, but there is also a separate fight she is having with the bowl of chocolates and whether she is going to take one and put it in her mouth. And
bowls, everywhere bowls.
Well, we did a fun episode. Everyone can go back and download it last year just on Betty Davis with a great movie and TV writer named LaToya Morgan, who's been obsessed with Betty Davis her entire life. And something LaToya brought up to us, which I've been watching in Betty Davis films ever since, is how Betty Davis will do everything she can to not give you her eyes. And then when she finally does, and in that scene that you're referencing, her dealing with the chocolates and finding her way around the room, she doesn't want to look up. She lets her hair get in front of her eyes. She does all these things. And then finally she comes up.
As it happens, there are particular aspects of my life to which I would like to maintain sole and exclusive rights and privileges.
For instance, what?
For instance, you.
And the whole run-up, that's the whole run-up to It's Going to Be a Bumpy Night. And it's so felt. That line is so repeated and cliched and all of these things. But her anxiety about Eve and her insecurity in her relationship and that, and the two martinis she had by herself, like that bubbling up of all of that is so real and felt throughout that scene that when she tells you that, it's earned and real and true.
Well, it's almost like she's making the decision with the picking of the chocolates. Like, am I going to have a bumpy night? Like, am I going to not be bad Margot or am I going to be good Margot? And then, you know what I mean? And that whole scene is her being like, okay, time to fuck some shit up.
Yeah. Am I hearing what I need to hear from him or am I not?
Right. And then the bumpy night line is like, again, her saying like, okay, I'm going to get into character. And this is the character I'm going to, like, I the information I have gotten in the last 5 or 10 minutes, this is the character I am choosing to react to that through.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
And let's talk about, let's just get into it. The 28-minute, how long is it? Wait, I wrote it down. It's a fucking, like, 32-minute party scene. The tent pole of this movie. And it is some of the most delicious cinema ever created.
Yeah. I mean, Joe Mankiewicz gets sort of discounted a lot by auteurists because they say he's more of a writer than a director, you know, and his movies are more about words than about images. But like the fluidity of that scene and the way it moves from room to room and upstairs to downstairs, like you understand the geography of that apartment, you understand the rhythm of that party, you understand the space, you understand the sort of ebb and flow of like when the party's really in full swing and when it's dying down. It's an incredible sustained piece of movie making and of course a beautiful piece of writing.
I can't get over, I mean, I think it might be the last shot of Thelma Ritter, And we can't even play it on here because it's a completely silent moment. But with Betty Davis drunk with her martini at the piano.
My favorite.
And Thelma tries to give her the coffee. And she ends up taking the olive and putting it into the coffee. It's Buster Keaton worthy in their movement and timing of that.
But there's also that Thelma Ritter knows she's not going to drink the coffee. Do you know what I mean? Like she mm-hmm. knows her so well that she knows that she can't stop this night and she can't stop, her mistress.
But she's going to give her the exit ramp. Yep. Yeah.
Try.
Right. I mean, and then like layered on top of that is just that beautiful two-line exchange.
Many of your guests have been wondering when they may be permitted to view the body. Where has it been laid out?
It hasn't been laid out. We haven't finished with the embalming.
Best like, line
if I wrote two
ever.
Sentences that good, I would be like, well, that's it for the day. Like,
there we
I'm
go.
Putting my feet up and watching Netflix because like I've done my work.
What is it she says to Eve at the end of the party when she's going to leave? When Betty goes to leave the party and she says,
don't get up. And please stop acting as if I were the queen mother.
I'm sorry, I didn't
Outside of a beehive, Margot, your behavior would hardly be considered either queenly or motherly.
You're in a beehive, pal, didn't you know? We're all busy little bees, full of stings, making honey day and night. Aren't we, honey?
Margot, really?
Please don't play governess, Karen. I haven't your unyielding good taste. I wish I could have gone to Radcliffe, too, but Father wouldn't hear of it. He needed help behind the notions counter. I'm being rude now, aren't I? Well, should I say, ain't I?
You're maudlin and full of self-pity. You're magnificent.
How about calling it a night?
And you pose as a playwright. A situation pregnant with possibilities, and all you can think of is everybody go to sleep.
It's a good thought.
It won't play.
As a non-professional, I think it's an excellent idea. Excuse me. Undramatic, perhaps, but practical.
Happy little housewife.
Cut it out.
This is my house, not a theater. In my house, you're a guest, not a director.
Then stop being a star. And stop treating your guests as your supporting cast.
Now let's not get into a big hassle.
It's about time we did. It's about time Margot realized that what's attractive on stage need not necessarily be attractive off.
All right. I'm going to bed. You be host. It's your party. Happy birthday. Welcome home. And we who are about to die salute you.
Need any help?
Put me to bed, take my clothes off, hold my head, tuck me in, turn out the lights, and tiptoe out. Eve would, wouldn't you, Eve?
If you'd like.
I wouldn't like.
She never really lets Eve have it, but the kind of underhanded, like, very subtle, these digs at her, and from the top of the stairs to the bottom of the stairs, that geography of the attack is so amazing.
Yeah. And then also in the middle of it, that she has this kind of private, funny interlude with Max, the producer, in the kitchen.
Yes.
Where in the pantry?
In the pantry, where, first of all, I love that Margot, you know, knows where the Broma Seltzer is kept. Like, yep.
We'll get it herself.
Right, we'll get it herself. And, like, one of the things that Betty Davis is so brilliant at playing is varying levels of drunkenness. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there's the drunken maudlin self-pity at the piano. There's the just pounded down two martinis and I'm ready to kill thing at the beginning of the party. And there's the theater drunk level of, like, I love everyone. You know,
I love you, Max. I really mean it. I love you. Come to the pantry.
She loves me like a father. Also, she's loaded.
It's so perfect. It's so great. And he's so wonderful.
She kind of gets her druthers back and makes a little plan in that scene.
Yep.
You know, makes a little plan to get rid of Eve that actually isn't terrible, that will just put Eve on a different path. that will be out of her fucking house, you know?
Exactly.
And it's cool. I love that. It's cool. I love that scene. I've forgotten about it.
And it's never, so, like I said, it's never, she, you always think that it's going to turn into this huge melodrama, especially that scene. I was like, here it comes. I'm going to, you know, it's going to go so over the top. And it's like, no, Eve's just trying to play it like anyone would play it. This person's kind of weird. This person seemed to be encroaching on my life and doing slightly inappropriate things, but she's still a young girl. Okay. Like, let's just get her a job and get her away from me. But it's like, she doesn't know all that we know. And that's the, some of the, what are the joy and tension of watching this and the real, and it's, and then until the very end, it's still kind of, I don't know, real world. Is that weird for to say for this movie?
No, it's very weird. I think it's very realistic in that in ways that people don't remember it, but also the contrast with the other rising actress, Miss Caswell, and Marilyn Monroe just like slam dunking three or four punchlines like right in a row. And I'm sure she was a pain in the ass to shoot with as she was on everything. But man, those jokes are good.
Right. And she lands them. I mean, she's really, really good in that movie. I think a lot of the gay love for All About Eve comes from that party scene. Because it's just the highest level of bitchy insults. I mean, one of my favorite things is when Margo introduces Miss Caswell and says,
Eve, this is an old friend of Mr. DeWitt's mother, Miss Caswell, Miss Harrington.
Like, that's just like, you know, that's so like one old queen being completely savage about another old queen having a much younger boyfriend. I mean, it's just
so good.
It's perfect, you know. It's just perfect. And you know, a lot of Margot's great lines are about age, you know, when she comes in and says milkshake. You know, it's like that's her way of saying how incredibly bothered she is by the fact that Eve's younger and as Margo says, she's about to be 40, and she's, you know.
3 months ago, I was 40 years old. 40. 4-0. That slipped out. I hadn't quite made up my mind to admit it. Now I suddenly feel as if I've taken all my clothes off.
It costs her something.
And Marilyn's great. Great line.
I'm afraid Mr. DeWitt would find me boring before too long.
You won't bore him, honey. You won't even get a chance to talk.
Right.
Like, it's just so, that scene.
And you know, Addison saying,
a waiter.
And that isn't a waiter, my dear, that's a butler.
Well, I can't yell, oh, butler, can I? Maybe somebody's name is butler.
You have a point. An idiotic one, but a point.
God, it's, and one of the great offstage characters in film history, in my opinion, the movie star who shows up.
Right, right.
And we only see her coat arrive and leaves. Oh, that's Thelma's last scene, is when she comes to collect the coat from Karen.
Well, that's... Right.
Like maybe Birdie dies under the whole pile of coats.
Or what if Birdie...
she suffocates.
Or what if Birdie gets revolutionary plastic surgery for that time and is really the sleeping girl in Eve's apartment? Think on
She's Barbara Bates.
Back on the board.
I call myself Phoebe, yeah.
Yeah, that's Birdie, baby.
You know, I mean, nothing is in the movie without a reason. And I think, as you said, the great unseen character, the movie star, pays off in a weird way in the Saracen's acceptance speech scene, where you learn that Eve is going off to Hollywood. Like, she, and you almost sense that, like, oh, she got the idea for her next thing by realizing that, you know, as grand as it is to be a Broadway star, look what happens when a movie star sweeps into a party. Right. You know?
Okay, so Mark, so everything's in there for a reason, but how, so you're already saying you don't like that, the iconic monologue she gives in Karen's car, or you don't like the end of the monologue where she's like, doesn't matter what you got, as long, if you can't get a casserole out of the oven for that hobby of yours, you ain't nothing. So what do we feel about about this romance? Margot and Bill's. That seems to propel strangely propel the action, but again, not as much as I thought it would. Not as much tension, which I so appreciate, right? It's not... overdub. What do we feel?
I mean, I don't think that Gary Merrill is an interesting actor. I don't think anyone would say that. But I think the idea of this 40-year-old star and her 32-year-old director being this kind of long-standing couple who put up with each other's difficulties and are very much in love, clearly. And Margot is never punished the way a lot of women in movies at that time would be for having a younger boyfriend. It's not made to be pathetic or embarrassing for her. I think that's pretty striking for the time. And also another thing that's really striking for the time is they are very clearly have sex. I mean, that's a sexual relationship and they're not married and nothing is made of it. And it's just like, of course they're having sex. I mean, they're a couple and how nice that they finally decide to get married. But you know, it's really interesting that there's no hint of punishment or judgment around that. In 1950, that's pretty unusual.
The other, I wonder if you know if this is true, but the lore I know of that scene in the car is that Betty Davis demanded that she turn the music on the radio because she didn't want to be underscored and she wanted to decide when she turned it on and when she turned it off.
Oh, that's really interesting. Well, I don't know if that's true or not, but it would be totally characteristic of her shrewdness and her awareness of how a performance of hers could be manipulated without her consent or changed in a way without her consent.
You want it on?
Doesn't matter.
I detest cheap sentiment.
Karen.
Mm-hmm. No, thank you.
I haven't been very pleasant this weekend. We've all been a little tense lately. Come to think of it, I haven't been very pleasant for weeks. For that, I'm truly sorry. More than any two people I know, I don't want you and Lloyd to be angry with me.
We're never deeply angry. We just get mad the way you do. We know you too well.
And so many people know me. I wish I did. I wish someone would tell me about me.
You're Margot. Just Margot.
What is that? Besides something spelled out in light bulbs, I mean. Besides something called a temperament, which consists mostly of swooping about on a broomstick and screaming at the top of my voice. Infants behave the way I do, you know. They carry on and misbehave. They'd get drunk if they knew how. When they can't have what they want. When they feel unwanted or insecure or unloved.
What about Bill?
What about Bill?
He's in love with you.
More than anything in this world, I love Bill. And I want Bill. And I want him to want me. But me, not Margot Channing. And if I can't tell them apart, how can he?
Well, why should he and why should you?
Bill's in love with Margot Channing. He's fought with her, worked with her, and loved her. But 10 years from now, Margot Channing will have ceased to exist. And what's left will be... what?
Margot, Bill is all of 8 years younger than you.
And those years stretch as the years go on. I've seen it happen too often.
Not to you, not to Bill.
Isn't that what they always say? Now, I don't suppose the heater runs if the motor doesn't.
It's silly, isn't it? You think they'd fix it so people could just sit in a car and keep warm?
About Eve. I've acted pretty disgracefully toward her, too.
Well,
don't fumble for excuses. Not here and now with my hair down. At best, let's say I've been oversensitive to her. Well, to the fact that she's so young, so feminine and so helpless. To so many things I want to be for Bill. Funny business, a woman's career. The things you drop on your way up the ladder so you can move faster. You forget you'll need them again when you get back to being a woman.
It's one career all females have in common, whether we like it or not. Being a woman. Sooner or later, we've got to work at it. No matter how many other careers we've had or wanted. And in the last analysis, nothing's any good unless you can look up just before dinner or turn around in bed. And there he is. Without that, you're not a woman. You're something with a French provincial office or a book full of clippings. But you're not a woman. Slow curtain, the end.
Although one thing I've always read about All About Eve is that she had the reputation of being a kind of terror coming in. And I think she and Mankiewicz always both said, nope, it was a perfectly smooth, happy shoot. They loved it. It mm-hmm. You know, she wasn't a problem. He wasn't a problem. She just kind of came in and nailed it.
That's what Ann Baxter said, too. Ann Baxter said that Betty was always very sweet to her and would sometimes greet her on set with a little hiss. Like, she would go, and it was like their joke every morning that they would hiss at each other and then go about the day, which is, I think, fabulous. But also, when you think about 16 Days, though, if I think about 16 Days, I think, well, that means she was probably shooting 4 days a week. I bet they gave her one day off a week, and that's a 4-week shoot, which is a pretty sizable chunk to shoot a feature, yeah?
Yeah, and also, they're long scenes. I mean, mm-hmm. It's not like cut. It's a bunch of like really great set pieces in the dressing mm-hmm. room, the party, you know.
The theater.
Right. So you could imagine getting a lot done in a day, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I love thinking about shooting this. That scene in the theater. Oh, another one of my favorite lines.
Playing that childish little game of cat and mouse.
Not mouse. Never mouse. If anything, rat.
So good. And that scene on the bed between her and Bill. I can't get over how much she, I mean, all the women in this movie are amazing, but how much she is able to imbue Margot with. If you look at the scene, herself alone in bed, calling Bill on his birthday, versus the scene of her and Bill in bed, like that woman contains all of those things is so miraculous to me, what Betty Davis is able to do in the scope of one movie.
Right. And her ability to show you what a character is thinking, or that the character is thinking and feeling different things or more than one thing at once, especially mm-hmm. in that scene, the bed scene that is the birthday phone call, mm-hmm. where you can almost see her start to think, okay, Eve has done me a favor, but she's also overstepped. And did she sabotage me by not reminding me of it? And like there's like something is going on in her mind that like it's the embarrassment that she didn't remember. It's the surprise that Eve did. It's the suspicion that Eve mm-hmm. did. It's gratitude at Eve for remembering. It's annoyance at Eve for not telling her. Like everything is playing out. And she's not forgetting that it's all supposed to be playing out while she's kind of drowsy and done for the day. Yeah. It's like she is doing a zillion things in that scene.
Now, and this is why it's all about Eve, because then Anna's like, how is she going to get out of this? And just perfectly, she comes in and she's like,
by chance, did you place a call from me to Bill for midnight California time?
Golly, I forgot to tell you.
Yes, dear, you forgot all about it.
Well, I was sure you'd want to, of course, being his birthday. And you've been so busy these past few days. And last night I meant to tell you before he went out with the Richards. I guess I was asleep when you got home.
Yes, I guess you were. It was very thoughtful of you, Eve.
Mr. Sampson's birthday. I couldn't forget that. You'd never forgive me. As a matter of fact, I sent him a telegram myself.
And I was like, this is my queen.
This is your deception queen.
This is my deception queen. She is so smart. Well, I just wish I could be just this much smart as Eve. Like, come on.
I want to be just as much smart as Birdie, because I love it. Almost it like creeps towards horror movie in the next bit when Birdie comes in and she says,
Well, let's say she thinks only about you anyway.
How do you mean that?
I'll tell you how. Like she's studying you. Like it was a play or a book or a set of blueprints. How you walk, talk, eat, think, sleep.
I'm sure that's very flattering, Bertie. I'm sure there's nothing wrong with it.
Right. And that's the whole, like, little teeny single white female moment. I mean, this is the prototype for so many things, culturally.
Well, Bertie is like Elvira, the housekeeper, in Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. Mm. Like, she knows what's going on. You know, she doesn't have the authority or the power to fix things. But from the beginning, she's got an absolutely clear bead on what the problem is and what the power dynamic is. I always love that kind of character in old movies. The character with, like, all the brains and none of the agency.
Yes, yes. And it's always, and Thelma Ritter is the master of that part. And also, I mean, I was looking at her fucking billing and all the press photos for this movie. None of them include Thelma Ritter. Mm. She's not included in any of it. Like, it's always just the couples, and like, her billing is way down. It's like, once they get the full sheet of people, she's in the second sized font.
Oh my gosh.
You know, it's like, it's really nuts, because the Oscars of it all, this, for all of you who don't know, is the only film to ever get 4 Academy Award nominations for women in acting parts. And I would love to talk to you about the Oscars of it all, because it's the greatest year for Best Actress ever, 1950.
Well, and how amazing what it's shared with. I mean, with Sunset Boulevard. It's just bizarre.
For Sunset Boulevard, Judy Holliday, who wins for Born Yesterday, Betty Davis and Ann Baxter, and who's the fifth?
Good question. Is it Eleanor Parker for Caged? Is it?
Yes, you're right. Eleanor Parker, Caged.
There you go.
You're right.
I get to keep my, like, gay ID card. I know that Betty Davis always said that she felt that she and Gloria Swanson split the vote. Interestingly, I never heard her say she and Ann Baxter split the vote. So there's a little of Margot in there.
A little shade. But Ann Baxter campaigned really hard to be put in Best Actress instead of supporting. And I think if she was in supporting, maybe Betty would have eked it out.
Right. Although, like, it's fair for Ann Baxter to have done that. She's absolutely a co-lead. Like, that's a big part.
She's the fucking title character.
Right.
The movie begins and ends.
But this is Margot's story. Yes, she's the title character, but this is specifically Margot, right? Or, yes, yes.
I don't know. I guess, no, the last face is Barbara Bates, but it's about Eve.
But see, I don't think it's about Eve. What do we think? Do we think that this story is trying to say that there's the young will always eat the old, and that no matter where you are, someone's coming behind you? Is that what this story is about?
You can't fuck with time. You can't fuck with time.
Well, time will fuck with you. Like
the second part, I think, no matter where you are, someone's always coming behind you. I mean, that's absolutely true, and it's in a way the point of the very last scene. You know, where Eve is about to get Eved. But on the other hand, I think the movie definitely suggests that Margot is going to survive and be just fine. That you know, Eve didn't destroy her. Like, she's sitting there at the awards, and you know, she's got her man, she gets the brutal last word to.
Oh, it's the best.
Eve. Nice speech, Eve. But I wouldn't worry too much about your heart. You can always put that award where your heart ought to be.
So she lives. She's not destroyed. And I always thought that's a great choice for the movie. And one of the reasons it has lasted so long is because it doesn't turn into this kind of only one can win bitch fest. Like, it likes Margot enough to let her live.
And that, to me, is the unexpected and then the realistic thing of this. And talk about the Betty Davis eyes of it all. There's something that Betty Davis plays knowingly about the relationship of entertainment in the theater, knowing that there's always the young that's going to come in and be celebrated, but also that she will still have a place. Like, I never got a sense that she was defeated. Do you know what I mean? Like, she just moved into another area.
by then she had lived through 20 years of being a Hollywood actress, you know, the rise and beginning of the fall of the studio system. She had seen actresses come and stay. She had seen actresses come and go. You know, she had lost parts to people. She had knocked people out of contention for parts. Like, she knew the score by then.
Okay. Well, she, Betty Davis, I mean, I don't even know if we're talking about Betty Davis or Margot at this point, but they're one.
I meant Betty Davis, but, you know.
But she, I mean, that's something, actors take note and take heart. Betty Davis was like the 12th choice for Margot. It was originally supposed to be Claudette Colbert, and that's why Anne Baxter was cast, because she looked like such a young Claudette Colbert. But there were so many other people asked to do this before Betty Davis. And then Betty Davis said that it single-handedly revived her career. No, she was in a huge career slump.
That's but right. I want to talk about this because, and I am naive enough to be able to think this through. So Mark, can you help? What? this was Betty Davis's first resurgence. But then when you look through her film or her next steps, it kind of doesn't do anything until they claim her next resurgence with Baby Jane. So I find it fascinating that everyone's like, oh, this one movie did. And then she has a pile of movies that no one talks about. And then Baby Jane comes out and everyone's like, this is the second coming of Betty Davis. And then again, another pile of movies.
Well, no, she made The Star after this, which was her ultimate takedown of Joan Crawford that she was nominated for the Oscar for.
Right,
in 52.
There are some nice movies in the 50s that she made, some okay movies. There's this thing called
The Virgin Queen.
Mm-hmm. A Catered Affair, if you've ever seen that. It's a sort of lovely oddball thing. But yeah, you're absolutely right that like this was a huge comeback, but not in a way a comeback on which she was able to
extend.
Stick the landing. The 50s were not a great decade for her, you know, it's really hard to know why that. I mean, she was getting to an age where, you know, a lot of actresses, when they hit 40 or 45, just sort of retired.
Right.
Or they went to television, like Loretta Young, you know, Jane Wyatt, Wyman. So, I don't know why instantly great part after great part, you know, didn't come her way. I mean, Katharine Hepburn, who was about the same age, was able to really keep going pretty effectively through the 50s. You know, she had a number of interesting parts then. And you know, Betty Davis, it's odd that she made some bad choices, but
listen, I just watched Dead Ringer the other day and it slaps. Dead Ringer's fucking amazing. God damn. She plays twin sisters. One kills the other. Watch it, y'all. It's fucking good. It costs like $2.99 to rent, but it's worth it. Fuck.
I would I've never seen her in a movie ever, including like the real throwaways from the early 1930s when she was doing like five movies a year.
Yeah.
Where she didn't do at least one really interesting thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're all... I mean, she's my top movie diva ever. I have a horrifying idea to put to both of you. I, while watching this movie this time, all of a sudden realized, I was like, oh, fuck. Ryan Murphy is going to make an origin story called Eve, where we're going to have to watch her in the brewery and do the whole thing. It's going to be Sarah Paulson, and I just can't fucking deal with it. I love Sarah Paulson, but I just can't deal with when Ryan Murphy decides to put his hands on this.
Who owns All About Eve? That's the question. It's probably Disney now, weirdly enough, because I think it was a Fox movie. So,
oh, fuck.
You know.
Disney Plus, here comes All About Eve.
So maybe what we're really looking at is like the animated version of All About
Eve. Oh, yeah.
That I'm here for. The Pixar All About Eve.
Oh, my gosh. Absolutely. The princess treatment. It's Frozen's All About Eve.
Okay, so here's my question for you. If that was to happen, who would be your today Margot Channing? If it had to happen, we had to do it, who would it be?
You're very interested in age, Nick. So are you really having us put
I mean, my choice is
because I think 40 is different than the 49 age. I think 40 is so much different now, though. So much. I mean, you're still 25 in this day and age when you're 40. So
that's true.
Right. It's I think the real casting question there is how old is Eve? How old is Margot? Like, you know, because are they really, you know, are they 26 and 40? Because that doesn't quite work now. I know that there have been a lot of attempts to update All That Eve. There was supposed to be one, I think, many years ago with, I'm thinking it was maybe Jane Fonda and Cameron Diaz. So that will tell you about when the right time was, that was supposed to be set in the world of like morning news. So every once in a while, people do think of like, is there a way to update or freshen All About Eve? And it always founders, I think, on like the age question and also the like, why would anyone want to go near that?
Well, we do, you guys, in a couple days on Thursday on Turkey Day, Jason and I are covering the Lauren Bacall of it all with Applause on the Patreon. So there's the one adaptation in the 70s. All the applause for Lauren Bacall and Dame Penny Fuller in that. But I just had the thought that Toni Collette would be a great Margot Channing.
See, I knew you would win.
Am I reading your mail?
No, I just knew you would win this game that you thought of.
Wouldn't Toni Collette be a great Margot Channing, though?
Yes.
Yes, it'd be pretty great. I mean,
And I think Janet McTeer would do it really great if it was like a play version. I know that Gillian Anderson did it, but...
I was thinking Olivia Colman, you know?
Ooh, Olivia Colman would be good. She's a little nice.
Right.
We're also doing, I think, a lot of our big-eyed goddesses, right?
Our big-eyed ladies. Has to be, big-eyed ladies to the front.
It all has to be the big eyes and to the front of the line that kind of tells you the story, kind of takes you through those emotions.
I think Eve is a hard, in a way, because like the talent pool for actresses who could play a Margot at different ages is so deep. I mean, there's so many great
Evan
actresses.
Rachel Wood as Eve.
Right, I was thinking like Emma Stone, you know, there's like who's, or you know, Anya Taylor-Joy, that young actress who was just in The Queen's Gambit on
Oh, yeah, she
Netflix.
Would be amazing. I'm just in the middle of The Queen's Gambit. I'm taking it very slowly.
Good going.
I'm loving it.
It's a lot of fun, yeah.
Taking it like a chess game. That would be a good casting. Fuck, I know Cate Blanchett was supposed to do the Eva Van Hove production before Gillian Anderson ended up doing it, both of whom, I think Gillian, I'm curious, I never saw the Gillian Anderson of it all, and I love her so much, but I think it's an odd choice for Margot.
I don't think the idea works on stage. I really don't. I think this is a movie. It's a movie about theater, but it's a movie. You need close-ups. You need micro moments. You need cutting. You know, it's too weird to have... to be watching a really good stage performance about a really good stage actress who, as you say, gives performances that we never see, which is really smart. It like blurs the lines too much. So the stage thing did not seem like, I didn't see it, but it did not seem like a great idea to me.
And I guess here's the thing, you know, as revolutionary as this film was, as still current, feeling, you know, 70 years later, this film still feels very current, still feels very ripe with like emotion. I don't know that this is, I don't know that we're in a time and for a long period of time that we're going to be here to be telling the story of women against women, of women destroying women. You know, that's the story that we've, and from here on out, we've, and then Sunset Boulevard, like, women who age is the story we tell. It's like the characteristic is that you're aging. And we don't know what to do with you, and you don't know what to do with yourself. I just don't know if that's the current moment right now, is to be like, you're old, isn't that bizarre? Like, where do we do with you?
Right.
I don't think it's the current moment, but I also don't think that All About Eve is in any way a movie that hates women, or that hates women for being women. So, you know, maybe in the hands of... a woman writer director, or a woman writer and a woman director, something interesting could be done with it, because to me it's a movie about really powerful, smart, ambitious women one of whom is a villain, you know, but that's okay.
Yeah. Which one?
We don't want to see movies when
Karen.
But you know, I'm also happy to see it left alone, like, you know, because it does not need updating.
No, it's perfect.
Because as you said, it like it still works. We're still talking about it.
It's so perfect. It's so beautiful. I'm going to throw one more moment in there I didn't get to mention that I saw for the first time this time, which is the only moment we get alone with Eve right after Bill leaves the dressing room. And she kind of takes off the wig and there's this ferocious, like, I'm alone moment where she's almost like a wild animal. And then Addison DeWitt comes in and we see her bottle it up again. It's so small and it's so brilliant. And that's when I was like, oh, fuck, Anne Baxter is a genius.
Right. And it sort of connects to, she's not alone in the very last scene of the movie, but there is a moment when she thinks she's alone.
Yes.
Before she sees, you know, Phoebe. And... yeah, Anne Baxter does this really weird thing both times of, like, whatever drops out of her when she's not being looked at, like, her real self when she's alone is terrifying. Mm-hmm. Because it's just kind of angry and brutish and, you know...
It's
like
she's like Kathy Ames from East of Eden, you know, it's that kind. You think that like there's that level of malevolence possibly inside of
her. But you know what? I think there's also this thing. She doesn't want to go to the party. And I think what this really there's a beautiful thing here that says that, you know, that age old saying, it's lonely at the top. So Eve has done all of these things and she has alienated everyone to get there. And where maybe Margot is at this middle ground place, but she still has her whole community with her. She still has her whole mm-hmm. support. And what all Eve has is this conniving Addison. And she doesn't want to. She's gained this thing, but she has no love in her life. You know what I mean? So she goes to her lonely apartment. And I think the things that she has done has caused that. You know, she can't find actual happiness. You can't ever get that with the statue. So
you've given me the perfect opportunity to plug my book, because I am Eve, I will now do. Like, this reminds me of something that Mike Nichols said, which everything reminds me of now because I've spent like 5 years on this book. But there's this point in the book where he goes to college at the University of Chicago and he kind of establishes this arch, nasty, kind of bitchy persona. At, you know, 19 or 20. But he also starts sleeping like 10 and then 12 and then 16 hours a day.
Oh, God.
And he said about it later, it's just completely exhausting to be a person that many hours a day. Like, that the sheer effort of creating a public persona just left him with nothing in his tank. So he had to sleep all the time. And in a way... like, Mike was not Eve, absolutely not. But I think when you have those couple of alone moments of Eve, what you're seeing is that like every single second that she is in the presence of other people, she is having to create herself and to create a completely false version of who she is. And so, of course, like the second she's alone, she looks like a prize fighter after a 15 round match. It exhausts her to be this non-existent person.
Oh, I can't wait to read this book. Also, everyone, you should get Mark's previous two books, Pictures at a Revolution and Five Came Back.
Yes.
They're two of my favorite books to give as gifts. If you have a film lover in your life and you're like, I don't know what to get them those books. Those are both available right now. I think this is like the most amazing conversation I could have imagined having about All About Eve, Mark. Thank you so much for coming on. Did we miss anything, Jay?
Mark, did we miss anything?
I'm sure we did, but that's the great thing about the movie. Like, it unfolds new things to you every time you watch it. But it was a total pleasure, guys, talking to you. It was really fun. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. Everyone fucking rent All About Eve when you're all filled with turkey and turn it on for the
whole family. Put on a gown. Stay at home.
Exactly.
Scream at your birdie.
And join us over at the Patreon to talk about Lauren Bacall and Applause and the musical version of this. And of course, download our back episode about Betty Davis with LaToya Morgan if you want to learn more about Betty Davis. And have a great holiday, everyone. We're thankful for everyone who listens to this podcast.
Stay safe, Battle Angels. Be good. We'd be all about you, Mark. Eve.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Bye.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.